Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to Contractor Evolution, the podcast by Breakthrough Academy. Our guest on the show today is Sean Van Dyke. He's the author of Profit First for Contractors and the Paperwork Punch List. Now, it depends on what study or report you look at, but averaged out, the consensus seems to be that the vast majority of construction and trades businesses net profit less than 5% a year. And that, by the way, in many cases, is before the owner even pays themselves. That's not good. You run a business, not a charity. And after speaking with many entrepreneurs who use this framework and rave about it, I wanted to have Sean on to discuss the Profit First for Contractors, or PFC model, and assess whether or not this cash management system delivers. It does. So today, we talk about the five bank accounts you need to set up right away, how a profit-first approach produces a powerful and positive psychological change to the way you see money flowing into and out of your business, and the four most common profit-destroying mistakes that Sean sees owners make over and over. I really hope you enjoy it. Let's dive in with Sean. You're listening to Contractor Evolution, the podcast by Breakthrough Academy, where we systemize contracting businesses for growth. Keep listening to learn how the world's top contractors scale their companies, build killer teams, and make more while working less. Sean Van Dyke, welcome to Contractor Evolution, man. It's good to see you.
Hey, Benji. Great to be here. Thanks for having me.
An easy one to start, okay? You wrote Profit First for Contractors a number of years ago. It's become, you know, very popular in the construction space for people who really need help making more money and getting control of their finances. I'm just curious, like, you know, what you were seeing in the marketplace however many years ago. I think it came out in 2017 or so. What you were seeing in the marketplace at that time that sort of made you feel compelled to write this?
Well, I wish that I could say that I had some smart reason behind it and I'd done all this, you know, analytics and thought, yeah, this would be a good fit for the marketplace. But it's really not as sexy as that. I just kind of stumbled onto it. So I'm a big nerd at heart, operations guy. And all I've been in since I graduated from college was in and around construction. So my family and I were on vacation. I tell the story in the book as well. Is that we went on a 30-day road trip. I was reading a bunch of books, listened to a lot of audio books to kill time while we were driving around the country. And one of those, I've always been a fan of Mike Michalowicz, and read all of his books, came across Profit First and was reading it. And I remember I told my wife, I was like, oh my gosh, the way that this guy talks about money and cash flow is very similar to how I've run my construction businesses or the other construction businesses that I operated. Is I don't know much accounting. I don't know all of that stuff, but it's a very practical way to look at money in, money out. And that started me down the rabbit hole when I was already coaching at that point, coaching contractors. And being a business coach, I'm a sucker for other business coaches or other coaching programs. So Mike had a coaching program. I signed up for it because I was like, I want to be certified in this. This is really good information. So that's really where it started for me. So I was a couple of weeks, maybe a month into my certification process with my Profit First coach, an employee of Mike's. And I just happened to mention that, hey, Mike should write a book for contractors, because I think this is very helpful, but he would need to change the way he talks about certain things because a contracting business is different than other general businesses. Then my coach said to me, well, why don't you write the book? And I was like, what are you talking about? And he was like, Mike will sell you the rights, a license to it. And it's called a derivative copy. And I even asked my coach, I was like, is that legal? And he was like, yeah. And then a week or 2 weeks later, I was on a Zoom call with Mike Michalowicz, the guy that I had looked up to and followed for a long time. By the way, the nicest, most generous person I've ever met. Wonderful guy. So we're just on a Zoom call and he's like, yeah, so I hear you're a contractor going through this. Yeah, let's get you writing a book. And I was like, again, Mike, is this legal? He's like, yeah, don't copy it word for word, but take it and use it for your audience and put it in terms that they'll understand. And then about an hour later, I walked out of my office and I told my wife, I was like, babe, I think I've got a book deal. And she was like, what book? And I was like, Profit First for Contractors. And she was like, isn't that already a thing? I was like, well, not the contractor version. I'm basically going to copy Mike's book. And then she asked me, she was like, is that even legal? And I was like, I don't know. He said I could. And that's really kind of how it started. And I'd never written a book before. I mean, I'd written a book more as a lead generation, the paperwork punch list and all that when I first started. And obviously had done a lot of writing with Fine Home Building and some other sites and that kind of stuff, but never a book. So I didn't know what I was getting into. And looking back now, I see how crazy it was. But meeting with Mike, he was like, all right, let's get this thing published by the end of the year. And I thought, you know, hey, I'm going to have 6 months to do this. And it was probably June, July or something like that of 2018.
Yeah.
And I thought, yeah, okay. So 6 months of writing the book. He was like, nah, let's just do it in 3 months. And so I was like, oh, okay. So then I went and bought a coaching program of how to write a book in 90 days because I didn't know any better. And I just followed those steps. And in 90 days, I had the book written. And that's what I tell people a lot of times. They're like, how'd you write the book? I was like, well, here's what I figured out is write the book, meaning words on paper. And 50%, 60% of that stuff that you write down will be garbage and you'll get rid of it. But most people, when they try to write a book, is they try to write and edit at the same time. Mm-hmm. And I learned just write, mm-hmm. write words on paper, even if it's garbage, because it's a lot easier to take, I think at the time, 60,000 words and pare it down to the 20 or 30. So wrote the book in about 60 or 90 days, another 30 days of revising it. And then I hired a copy editor to actually put, you know, to kind of polish that turd. So that was again, none of it was planned. It was completely stumbled all the way through. And then that's how the book became to be, almost really purely by accident.
But there was something that obviously clicked for you about it when you read Profit First by Mike Michalowicz. I'm just wondering, like, your experience in construction, your experience coaching construction at that time, you obviously knew a lot about the landscape and some of the challenges that builders had. What on an intuitive level kind of clicked for you about this framework?
Yeah, it really went back to my first construction company. And after about the first year of operating my first construction company, like many contractors, many people out there are listening, they've had the same experience, is they get their taxes filed, they send off everything to the CPA, and then the CPA says, okay, you owe $20,000 in taxes. And I'm like, what? And they're like, yeah, that's how these things called taxes work. And so I had that experience going, I don't have $20,000. And so it was a scramble to figure out, how am I going to pay the tax bill? How can all of this money come through my business? And I thought that I was doing everything right, but now I still have this tax bill. Where did the money go? And so after that very painful experience, I told my CPA, I said, okay, and I don't remember exactly where the numbers were. I probably had a $500,000, $600,000 small remodeling business, not very big at all, but still had a $20,000 tax bill. And I was like, okay, if I'm going to do, for example, $1 million in revenue next year, based on what my tax bill is this year, and I told this to my accountant, I said, it looks like I need to set aside 4% of every dollar that comes in, and that'll cover my tax bill. And my CPA, being like most CPAs, this isn't a slam on CPAs, but he said, no, that's not how you calculate your taxes. And I was like, I know that, That is still how, it's still how the math works. Your job is to calculate the dollar amount of my taxes, but I'm looking at $500,000 in revenue with a $20,000 tax bill, the $20,000, you know, the money I owe divided by the money that I brought in, that gives me a percentage.
Right.
I'm just going to set that percentage aside going forward. And again, he said, that's not the way you calculate your taxes. So I just said, oh, okay, I'll just listen to you. And I did it anyway.
Yeah.
And then the next year came and he said, hey, I got some bad news.
You owe 40 grand in taxes.
He's like, you got a $12,000 tax bill.
Right.
And I was like, awesome. And he was like, no, did you hear, you owe $12,000 in taxes. And I was like, yeah, I got 18 sitting in my bank account over here. Mm-hmm. No problem. When do I write the check to you? How do I get it? You know? And so going through that experience a few years before, and then when I read Mike's book, that was kind of, oh, this is what I stumbled upon before, and stumbling upon it, that's what I've been using in my coaching business. But Mike's system and his framework obviously was put together really well. So that was what really clicked for me when I read the book. I was like, oh yeah, the thing that I was doing before, this guy not only had figured it out, but there's a whole system around it. Mm. I want to jump on board with this guy and this method.
That makes total sense to me about how that would sort of set up or frame your thinking on this for to sort of receive the wisdom that's packed into this book. I am going to get you to do kind of a brief synopsis of the model in a second. But before we do, you've got a pretty good aggregate perspective. Obviously, talking to a lot of contractors, doing it yourself for many years, coaching many of them actively as clients. In your estimation, from your vantage point, why is like minimal profitability, and I'm talking less than 5% net, why is that so commonplace in this industry?
Well, I think most of the time because, and I mean this with all sincerity as a compliment to contractors in general, I can kind of see through the rough and tough exterior on, you know, most contractors, because it is a hard industry to be in. You gotta, not only physically you build up calluses, but you also, I probably build up some mental calluses, but most of the contractors that I work with and that are good people, they have good hearts. They are people pleasers at heart. They get a lot of enjoyment of standing back. They don't need a lot of accolades. They don't need a lot of applause, because they can stand back and look and point at something that they built and knowing, yeah, I did that. And their clients are happy and there's smiles on their faces. And that's ultimately what probably feeds them maybe emotionally or spiritually. But the reason that they aren't as profitable as they should be is because making a profit means that you have to have a lot of hard conversations with clients. And so, for example, you look at a project and those initial conversations, you're thinking, yeah, this is whatever, a $250,000 project or a $2 million project, whatever it is. That's what your gut tells you. And so you probably, to make the client feel good, say, yeah, this is about where the budget is. Then you actually get more information and more details about that. And you realize, oh, crap, this project's going to be like $2.5 million. Or you actually finally see the architect's plans and you realize, holy crap, this is a $5 million project. They think it's $1 million. And I said something before, they're going to hate me when I... they try to avoid that conversation thinking they can outwork it or they'll make up for it somewhere else. And so I think that it ultimately comes from the contractor not being comfortable with the hard part of business. They think producing the work and making the clients happy leads to money. And it's usually the opposite. The more, this sounds weird, but the more you give away to make a client happy, yeah, they're going to be really happy because you're not charging them for all of the costs or the value that it is that you're providing to them. So I think that's inherently where a lot of the lack of profitability comes from, is because it's hard for a lot of contractors to separate, here's how we make the clients happy, and this stuff over here is going to be a difficult conversation, but it's the truth. And ultimately, I think the kindest thing you can do for somebody is tell them the truth. And when they come to you and say, hey, we've got $1 million project. Okay, how do you know that's $1 million? Our architect said so. And then every contractor listening to this is going to, and I've asked this on Instagram, I've done polls on this. I said, hey, if an architect said, not to slam any architects, but I'm kind of already there. Hey, if an architect says it's $1 million project, how much is it actually going to cost?
That's a good bit.
It's no contractor ever replies back, oh, you know, $1 million, right? So that's a difficult conversation. It doesn't make clients happy, but it's the truth. And being able to, I guess, probably compartmentalize that and tell people, hey, this is going to be really hard. It's not going to make you happy, but it's part of the process. We just got to work through it. So they just say, yeah, we'll just get to work and we'll figure it out.
So you are saying that despite the big beard and the big truck and the macho demeanor, a lot of these guys are actually pretty soft.
They're big and not soft.
I shouldn't say guys. They're
big teddy bears on the inside.
Big teddy bears.
They just want to make people happy with the skill or their superpower, which is building great stuff.
It's incredibly well said. And that's been my observation as well. I want to get to the model here, guys, but I got to talk about wardrobe. So everyone, this episode is sponsored by Michael with Dudonis Construction. They're a GC based in Springfield, New Jersey, specializing in high-end residential and light commercial. They've been at Breakthrough Academy for 3 years. They started at $1.5 million a year and are now doing $4.5 million a year in revenue. The biggest thing that we have taken away from Breakthrough Academy is the MBP file. That's our master business planning file. It's our kind of proprietary financial tracker. And the yearly budget thought process. It seems so simple, but we never did it. And our business is changing now. Michael, thank you for the outfit. If you want to check out Breakthrough Academy and what we do, it's pretty cool. There will be links in the description below this video, or if you're on the podcast app, you can find it there too. Thanks for the stuff, Mike. Sean, okay, let's do this. I'm kind of putting you on the spot here because you did write a whole book about this. So, but as well as you can you give us like a brief synopsis, the salient points of the Profit First for Contractors model, like the podcast version,
sure.
The podcast friendly version. We don't want to get super, super technical, but I do want to go deep enough that it kind of clicks for people, because there is something very profound embedded in this whole way of doing financial tracking and cash management, et cetera. So take it away.
Sure. I always say it like this, is that one of the rules of Profit First for Contractors is that your revenue is 100% of your budget. So if you've ever looked at your P&L, which can be very confusing for a lot of contractors or most business owners in general, it's full of a bunch of numbers. But if you'll run your P&L with the percentage turned on, you'll see that always that top line, whatever, let's just say we're looking at it from January 1st to December 31st, the money that came into the business, $100,000, $1 million, $10 million. Right next to that, whatever the dollar amount is, there'll be a percentage. And that percentage for your income is 100%. If you spend more than 100% of your money, you're in trouble year over year, right? So that's where we kind of start, is saying the profit first method is to say, there's a lot of fancy accounting and you need that, but what we're talking about is cash management. There are plenty of businesses that are profitable on paper, but they go out of business or they struggle because they don't have any cash. Mm-hmm. So we're just focused on money in, money out, and a cash management strategy. So we're going to start with 100%, and the owner of a construction company probably knows how much they pay themselves on a yearly basis. Okay, where does that money come from? No, sure. Again, we're not going to complicate this by saying, oh, maybe we have some investors, maybe we have some loans. We're going to clean all, we're not talking about any of that. We're talking about what you do to produce money to come in. It's 100%. All right, let's just say $1 million revenue business and I'm the owner and I work in the business and I want to pay myself $100,000. $100,000 of a million is 10%. We've just spent 10%. We have 90% left. Now I can take a look at, well, what are other things that we buy and go right back out the door? And again, here we'll talk a little technical, cost of goods sold, materials, labor, subcontractors, and equipment. You can look at your profit and loss statement, add up that number, and it's going to give you a percentage. Now, back to the cash management model. We start with 100, 10% goes to the owner, and now we have 70% of the revenue left is maybe cost of goods sold. Okay, 10 plus 70 is 80. Now we have to pay everything else out of what's left, 20%. And if we want, let's say, for example, 10% net profit, which I think is a more healthy range for a construction company, right? Then we've got 10% owner, 70% cost of goods sold. We got this 20% left. 10% of that we want to set aside for profit. That means 10% is left to pay the expenses of the business or to run everything else. And that's where it's like, oh, we don't have enough money. 10% isn't enough. We might need 20% based on this. Again, we're going back to the revenue. So it's like, oh, if our expenses are some dollar amount, we need to make sure that that percentage lines up with the other expenses or the other money going out in our business. So that's the simplest way to look at it, is to categorize the money in, money out in the way that it's being used. And the the priority that we apply in profit first is saying, okay, the first thing that you can consider is profit. Mm. That's the reason you are in business. So you need to figure out, well, what is the profit of the existing business I have right now? And a lot of contractors, this is where you got to dig into the math and you might need to organize your books or dig a little bit deeper. But to say, technically, when we consider all the, we're not making any money. So guess what? You can't go and just say, I'm going to put 10% in a profit account because you don't have it.
Correct.
It's not existing in the money that's coming in now. It could be a goal that we want to get to, right? So today I might say we're actually at 0% profit, but profit is the reason that you are in business. And if you're not making a profit and you're running a business, you're not, or you own and operate a business, you're not actually running a business. Mm. You're running a charity. Mm-hmm. Let's just cut to it. Mm-hmm. You don't have any profits. You're a charitable organization. So with zero profits, but want to get to 5, 10, whatever the percentage needs to be, where do we start? Just start with 1%. You're not going to miss it, right? This is where we get into the psychology of it. $1 million business, 1%, $10,000. You can run the business off of the $990,000 that's left. Your business wants to eat up every dollar that you don't prioritize.
One of the really fundamental premises of this whole system is this idea of setting up separate accounts. So can you just, and I think for, because some people may run this model already, they get it. For someone who doesn't or has never heard of this, I think that this will help really frame up the whole concept. So in the book, you're very, very pretty directive. You're like, go do this now. Set up these accounts. What are the five accounts, and sort of how do we categorize them differently? How do we think about them differently, and why are they important?
Yeah, so there's five accounts. So I'll list them, and then the way that I list them is also the priority of them in your business.
Okay.
So first and foremost, we have the income account, we have the profit account, we have the tax account, we have the owner's compensation account, and then number five is the OPEX. So those are the five foundational accounts. When you get a little bit more advanced, you can add some other accounts. But in general, it's those five. So let's start with the order of priority. The income account. You got to sell something in order to be in business, right? So the income account, we say, serves as a pass-through account, meaning all of the money comes into the income account. And then as we get into the details a little bit more, every 2 weeks or every month, yeah, you go into the income account and you do your distributions or your disbursements or whatever.
You call it the serving platter. It's like all the stuff. If you've had a big family barbecue, it's like all the, you know, the barbecue chicken goes on this big serving platter, and then you're serving the other smaller dishes, the individual dishes off of that. Nobody eats off of the serving platter. Nobody eats off of the income plate. It just sort of is the mother load for these other ones who it delivers, you know, numbers to, dollars to.
Yeah. And it's a little bit weird because what you want to do in the income account is zero it out.
Right.
Every, let's call it 2 weeks. Right. And that seems really weird because you're like, if my bank account gets to zero, I'm screwed. And it's like, yeah, if you just like it, for example, when the serving plate has no food on it, you could be out of food. But if you said, nope, I got the kids' plate set over here, I got the adults, I got some dessert over, I've moved all of that food to these different plates, I can look at an empty plate and go, nope, everything's taken care of because we've been purposeful about where the money's going. So that's the income account. It serves the purpose so that a business owner can also drop into the bank account and look at the income account over a 2 week period. And let's just say that the last 2 weeks I dropped in and there was $50,000 that had come into the business and I dispersed the money. All right. I don't have to run a financial report. I don't have to do any tricky accounting stuff. And then in 2 weeks from now, I go back in. Hey, how much money has come in? $25,000. I can remember, wait a minute, I think it was about 50 2 weeks ago. Why is it so much lower? And so part of what we say is the income account shows us the cycle of cash flow, you know, at least coming into the business. And we can remember, wait a minute, what happened over the past 2 weeks that is not $50,000? It's down to 25, right? And then whatever the answer is to that question, you go fix it. Now, 2 weeks go by, I drop back into the income account, I'm going to do my disbursements again, and I see $100,000 come in. I can say, what did we do right? I want to go repeat it. So you're dropping into the income account saying, do we need to fix something or do we need to replicate something? We fix the stuff that may be wrong. We need to get our invoicing out. We need to charge our customers for the change orders. We need to go, as I say, we need to go get Guido and the baseball bat and break some few kneecaps to get some people to pay, you know, all of those things, right? That's what gets the money coming in. When we're doing all of those things, we see it directly in the income account. We don't have to wait to get a hold of our CPA or our bookkeeper to say, hey, how are we doing? You kind of see that, that trend. So that's the income account. Profit account is pretty obvious. That's the reason that you're in business. We want to put money into the profit account and set it aside and get it out of our view so we don't touch it. And then the tax account, at least in the United States anyway, most other places, when you make a profit, you will pay taxes on it. So those kind of are tight. If I'm setting money aside for profit, but I'm ignoring my taxes, then I'm going to have some problems. So we might as well, we set the profit aside and the appropriate amount, percentage, dollar amount, whatever, in the tax account. And those accounts, we don't mess with. And if we do, if we run into a cash crunch, then it's actually a little bit, it should be a little bit painful saying like, oh man, I got to make payroll next week. I don't have enough money, say, in my operating account. When we dip back into the profit account, it should be a little bit painful going, we're not as good as I thought we were, or we got some other cash flow problem. So it's a simple way. It's more psychology and controlling our behavior than it is really math. You got to do the math, but that's what the profit and the tax account serve is to make sure that money is free and clear. Because like I said before, your business wants to chew up every dollar where it's at. Now, we got the income, we got the profit, we got the tax. Those are all serving our businesses in that way. Now, we deal with the owner's compensation account. And I always say it like this is, I see most construction business owners aren't paying themselves, especially if they work and work in the business. They aren't paying themselves enough. So if they got hit by a bus, the business can't afford to hire the two or three people it would take to replace them. Mm-hmm. And the problem here, I'll go on a little tangent here. A problem here that I see with a lot of construction companies, especially big ones, we're talking 10, 20, maybe even $30 million in revenue, is those owners might be paying themselves $250,000, $300,000, $400,000. And I've seen this happen before, working with a client that was doing $25 million in business. And he was like, I pay myself $250,000 salary and pull out another $100,000 a year. And I'm like, man, that's $350,000 coming to you. That's a pretty good life. It buys a pretty good lifestyle. Let's take a look at the 35 million reasons why that's all screwed up. You're getting a very small percentage. $350,000, don't get me wrong. That's a good chunk of money. But the risk for the $35 million that's coming in or $25 million, you're way out of whack with your percentages. That business should be paying you $2.5 million or at least providing you with that level of cash. So that's why we want to make sure and set the owner's compensation aside so that we can see, based on the revenue that's coming in, that money that I'm paying myself, if I didn't work in the business, is it enough to replace me? And it's almost always
not enough.
So now money's coming into the business. Good. We're in business. That's the income account. The reason we are in business is profit. We've set that aside. Those are our priorities. When we make a profit, we're going to pay tax. So we got to account for that. Now we have an account for the most important employee in the business, which is the owner. That's the reason, I hope everybody has great employees that work for them, but we can cut to the chase. The most important employee is the owner. Without that person, the business doesn't exist. And a lot of times those owners are, I always say that a lot of times owners need to take an employee mentality. Like in general, in leadership, we want to say we want our employees to have an ownership mentality, right?
Yep.
But I tell owners, you need to have an employee mentality when it comes to compensation, because if you don't pay your employees what their salary is or whatever, guess what? They're not going to show up to work. But owners, they'll skip paying themselves and still show up to work tomorrow. And I say, you need to think like an employee and say, you know what? this business isn't paying me enough. I got to fix it or I can't continue to work 60, 70 hours a week for basically minimum wage. Now, we've gotten all that taken care of. The last account is the OPEX account. And this is what's a little bit weird about the, or this is what's very clarifying, I should say, about Profit First. The OPEX account probably is the account that has the most money in it at any given time, but it comes last in the order of priority. Meaning, we got to take care of these other things first. Otherwise, we're just running a business for the sake of moving money, you know, money in and out. So the OPEX account,
which
is
by the way, sorry, just to clarify, yeah. It's operating expenses. And just to define that, operating expenses is cost of goods sold and overhead together, correct?
Well, the way that we talk about in Profit First, let's back up to forget the income account for right now, because that's just money in, money out, right? Zeros out. People ask me this. They're like, they mix the Profit First in the accounting terms. And they say, well, what all is included in operating expenses? If it's not profit, if it's not tax, and it's not owner's comp, it's everything else.
Right.
Right. Now on the accounting side, let's take off our Profit First hat and say, oh, well, there's this thing on my P&L called expenses. There's this thing called cost of goods sold. Yep. And the operating expenses on Profit First are a combination of those two things. But like in the expenses, if the way that the owner pays them himself or herself is in the accounting expenses, then that's not part of Profit First, because we've got a bank account specifically for that. So that's gets a little bit technical there, but operating expenses from a Profit First terminology is if it's not profit, tax, or owner's compensation.
It's OPEX.
So, right?
That is the biggest bucket. And generally speaking, it would get the largest sums of money put into it, but it is deprioritized to the bottom. In other words, that transfer gets made last after the other few do. Now, I have a really important question here, which is, On one level, someone could listen to you walk through that, and I appreciate kind of the overview of it. Someone could listen to that and listen, okay, we set up these different accounts and I move this much here and this much there. Got it. But at the end of the day, like I'm just sort of like, am I actually adding any value here? I'm just like shuffling dollars from here to here and from here to there, and I'm playing this game with myself that makes me feel like I'm doing something, but I'm really not. It's all, at the end of the day, it's the same amount of money in, it's the same amount of money out. Like, what's the value? And so I'm sort of playing devil's advocate here to just set up the question for you. There's actually something, it's not about having five accounts as much as it is about the psychological effect that setting this up has on the owner, the way that they think, the way that they make decisions, or the way that they deploy resources. So I really want you to make the case for why this isn't just a make work exercise about setting up five different accounts so we can feel nice, and the profound effect that it has on the psychological part of this.
Yes. So I'll answer that question with a little bit of a story or an exercise that I'm going to walk you through, and then the listeners can participate this at the same time. All right. So yeah, it sounds like a lot of work and the math is all the same. Listen, Profit First, foremost, is more about cash management and our behavior towards money than it is about accounting. So, and I tell people this all the time, that the profit in your business has more to do with your behavior than it does the math. And I can prove it to you. So I'll ask you this question, Benji, and everybody else listening here. You got to answer this question. What did you do in the bathroom this morning?
Showered. It's a very personal question, but I showered.
It is a very personal question.
I mixed up my athletic greens. Yeah.
Okay. Anything else? Any part of your normal morning routine in the bathroom?
No, I think that was it this morning.
Okay. So I'll ask, did you brush your teeth?
I don't think I did this morning.
Well, that's disgusting. But anyway, let's just assume you have brushed your teeth before.
I have. Yeah.
Okay.
I mean, so nighttime
brusher.
Let's
talk about that behavior. You're brushing your teeth. All right. So let me ask you, what do you do when you run out of toothpaste?
I depends where I am, but a lot of the times I'll just sort of like look, I'll sulk, I'll kind of go, and then I just do like a dry brush, a water brush, and then I make a reminder on my phone to go get toothpaste tomorrow.
Yeah.
Sue me. So, that's what I do, guys. Look.
That's all right. That's right. In general, when I ask that question, I do this from the stage all the time. So I'll tell, hey, what do you do when you run out of toothpaste? And instinctively, people just say, well, go get more toothpaste. And I would say, no, you do not. Not at first. Right. We go into the bathroom every morning. We grab a full tube of toothpaste when we have a new one and we just squeeze and go. We don't even pay attention to the amount of toothpaste that we put on our toothbrush, and we brush our teeth, and we continue this behavior day after day after day until we run out of toothpaste. And then in general, I find that there are three types of people in the world. One I would call the rollers.
Right.
So empty, air quotes, empty tube of toothpaste. And then we roll it up from the bottom. We use our thumbs and we squeeze out just a little bit more, right? That little bit more that we get is not nearly as much as what we've used in previous days when we had toothpaste, but it's enough to get by, right? So that's person number one, roller.
Yep.
And then after a few days of that, we do go get a new tube of toothpaste.
It's really,
and we repeat.
Yeah, it's really tapped out at that point.
It's really tapped out. So we have the rollers. We have the ironers. I'm an ironer, so I will take my toothbrush and iron out the toothpaste.
Right, gotcha.
Right, push it all the way up to the bottom, get a little bit more, and I'll do that for a couple of days until I'm really out. And then we have what I call the MacGyvers. I've done this before. I always have a pocket knife with me. So I'll cut open a tube of toothpaste and run my toothbrush in there to avoid the dry brush, right? But just a little bit more. Anyway, all right. We all do that. Normal human behavior. And the reason that Profit First works is because of that behavior. It actually has a name. It's called the law of induced demand. And you can look this up, or it's called Parkinson's law. Mm. What Parkinson's law states is that demand grows to meet the available supply. So full tube of toothpaste, huge supply, squeeze and go. Almost empty toothpaste, guess what? Somehow, magically, we get by on much less. And so with the Profit First method, since that is normal human behavior, let's translate that to the bank accounts. Mm. When we have a business and we have, let's say, one bank account and it's full of money or it has money in there, we look at that bank account and go, good, I can make payroll, I can spend money, I can do some other things. Then when that bank account gets really, really low, we say, holy crap, I need to get really efficient with this. I need to cut back on some expenses. I need to get Guido and the boys to go out and get some more money. We act differently based on the available supply. And so that's why Profit First for contractors work is because we're taking a full tube of toothpaste and intentionally making smaller tubes of toothpaste or smaller plates, as we refer to it in the book. So that when I look at my OPEX account, I'm just looking at the money it takes to operate my business. I'm not thinking about, because that's what I got to do to operate the business. I'm not going to touch the tube of toothpaste over here that's my profit or my taxes. Those are serving a specific purpose. So that's why Profit First works on a psychological or a human behavior, because we're actually leveraging what we already do as human beings. And people will say, well, you know, I don't do that with the toothpaste. Great. You do it with the roll of toilet paper or you do it with the shampoo bottle, but we don't need to go there.
Yeah, you do something else. You do it with a bottle of nice wine. You're just kind of like getting the last few drops out, or a good beer that you like, whatever. Like, there's so many
examples. Yeah, we say, oh, that's enough. And if that little bit of toothpaste is enough to get by, technically, that's the amount of toothpaste we should be using even when we have a full tube of toothpaste. But
yeah, this
we use way more.
It's a very interesting point, and I'm just kind of thinking out loud here. I feel like this is like incredibly important for newer business owners, especially in the first 10 years of operating. I think at a certain level of maturity, you've been doing it for decades. All of the financial discipline would be sort of baked in mentally, whether they're running Profit First or not. They've been burnt too many times to like not fall for this, the gag, which it kind of is, which is this: as an individual, just as a person in your life, we're not really, I think for the most part, unless you're like a hedge fund kid, like designed to look at a bank account with 100K in it or 500K in it. Like it'll be like very like weird for the average person. So when you start a business, you start to collect deposits, you start to collect big checks. Even a small $300,000 a year painting business is at times going to have pretty large sums of money in the account. And that plays a trick on you. Like it's false abundance, right? And you sort of look at it and you go, wow, there's all, you know, maybe we will get the new vehicle, or maybe we will, my crew says they want a sprayer, I'm going to go buy one for them. But it's false. Like that is not actually your money. And that is, there are already, there are already hooks into many of those dollars in the account, and they're delayed because of, you know, the way that AR and AP works, the way that taxes are sort of done cyclically, the way that payroll is structured. And so what you're trying to do, to just sort of put a bow on this, is you're trying to create a system to not allow you to fall for the trick of fake abundance in that account, correct?
Yes. So what the analogy that I use in the book is I love to fly fish, right? So I'm a big fly fisherman. I'm not very great at it, but I still love to do it, right? One of the tools that a fly fisherman will use if they want any sort of level of success is to wear polarized sunglasses. And what polarized glasses do for you, it allows you to see below the surface, beyond what you think is there, and gives you a little bit better view as to where the fish is, how they're moving, how they're reacting. That's what Profit First and the bank accounts do, is they're like polarized sunglasses for your business to say, like that painting business, oh, we may have $75,000 in the bank account, maybe more money than we've ever had in there. But instead of seeing $75,000 in one bank account thinking we have it, when I say, oh, I've only got $15,000 in operating expenses, I was thinking about buying a new truck, $10,000 is over here for my compensation, yeah, or whatever, here's some taxes and here's some profit. Oh, gosh, with the available cash that I'm viewing right now is only $10,000, I don't think we can make a $40,000 investment in a new van.
Right.
You have $75,000 in the bank account, I'm going to be like, hell yeah, let's go get a $40,000 van. We still got 30 grand left over. And that's what it does. It basically puts your money in the appropriate bucket, mm-hmm, and lets you see, mm-hmm, and gives you certain visibility below the surface of the profit and loss statement, below the surface of the bank account, and see the money that's in our business. A lot of times it's already spoken for.
Mm-hmm. Really, really powerful point, and I'm glad that we unpacked that. A couple, maybe just practical questions about how this works. I'm sure someone is wondering, can you talk about percentages for each account and then maybe transfer frequency? Like, when are we doing this? Is it every time there's a deposit? That seems like a lot of work. Is it done monthly? Like, how do we operationalize this a little bit?
Sure. Yeah, I'll give you some high level. These are
high
rules
level,
of thumb.
Super high level. Yeah.
If most people, when they read the book, they start to understand their finances, or at least their cash flow, for the first time. Again, we go into a lot more detail about margin and markup, charging clients for estimates, pre-construction, you know, all these different ways to increase cash flow. So we're going to kind of skip over that. But in general, some of the percentages in there, I would say, hey, you want to have about 6% in your profit account, 4% in your tax account. Now, you add 6 and 4 together, that's 10%. Mm. That's going to be what you would see on the accounting side, on the P&L, 10%, right? So that's where I was like, hey, let's try to get to 6% and 4%. 6% for taxes, 4% or sorry, 6% for profit, 4% for taxes. In general, I want owner's compensation to be somewhere around 10% of the total revenue. So now we've spent 20% of the available money. Then the operations expense account, depends on business, could be 70 to 80%, mm, right? Mm-hmm. So those are some high level percentages. And so a lot of people, they read the book, they'll see that 6% or the 10% between profit and taxes and be like, oh man, I can do this. I just set up a bank account. I move 10% of every dollar that comes over there. And that's pretty dangerous unless you've analyzed and said, and find out that, oh, 4 to 6% in your profit account, your business can actually afford that. So I say, those are the high level percentages and those are some goals. When you're starting out, just test yourself. Your business will show you whether or not that cash is available by putting 1% in profit and 1% in tax.
Right.
And then don't even set up the other accounts just yet. Prove to yourself that you can move 2% of all of the money that's coming in free and clear and you never have to touch it. And you do that for 3 months. And then you say, yeah, I didn't miss that. So let's just do that again. Then you bump it up another. Now we're putting 2% into profit, 2% into tax. And you go another 3 months and say, yeah, I think my business can afford. Then when you get to that, hey, let's go. Maybe we can double it up and go from 2% to 4% in profit and 4% in tax. And then you start seeing like, ooh, there's a cash crunch in everything else. That's going to tell you exactly where your business is at. I'm not sure we're actually making this much money. So give yourself 3, 6, 9 months to implement profit first very slowly, because the next 5 to 10 years are going to fly by.
Baby steps.
Don't
try
to do it all at once.
Yeah,
baby. Start with 1%.
And how often are you making the transfers? Like, how often is someone getting into their banking and doing this?
Technically, we call it the 10-25 rule or the 10-25 habit. On the 10th and 25th of the month, we drop into our income account and we disperse the money to our other accounts.
Yeah.
But that's in general. A lot of people say, well, I can't wait that long. Again, because cash flow is tight. You'll have to be in there more often moving things around a little bit. But the goal is once you, and this is the other, you know, offshoot of this, is once you start looking at the money, you're going to be very aware of like where the slush starts to build up in different accounts.
Right.
And you're like, oh, okay. I know that this bill is due in 2 weeks or whatever. I don't have to pay it now. We've got the money set aside. Nothing else is, you know, clamoring for that money. I don't need to pay this today. I can wait next week or whatever. And you get into that 2 week rhythm. So when you're starting out, you'll probably need to visit your income account a little bit more, move money around, because money is pretty scarce in your business, mm-hmm. right? So give yourself some time to get to that every 2 weeks.
Love it. Thank you.
You have my permission. But some people go the other way and they're just like, every check, they deposit the check, then they move the money as soon as the check clears. Mm-hmm. That's probably not very productive and it's probably a little bit too stressful.
Yeah, but it's a little frenetic.
Yeah,
yeah.
But
wait.
Eventually, every 2 weeks, like in my construction company now, we've got it set up so that we do it about every 2 weeks. It also matches up with our payroll and also our billing cycle to our customers. So I'm like processing billing for our customers. I'm running payroll and then I drop in to profit first and do it every 2 weeks.
Beautiful walkthrough, amazing setup. I've got a few other things I want to ask you about with the time that we have together here. So let's do a few quick fire profitability mistakes. You have the privilege of being in the books of a lot of different businesses, so you can kind of see this. You'd mentioned four things that are absolute killers: not charging enough, not understanding baseline accounting systems and practices, over hiring, and then I love this one, incentivizing employees to do their jobs. Why don't you just unpack each for me?
Sure. Yeah. So not charging enough is pretty straightforward. That comes down to understanding the difference between margin and markup. And we could spend a whole hour long podcast just talking about that. But really what it comes down to, and not charging enough, is contractors are usually not very aware of the actual costs of a project. So I'm a big proponent of if it costs me $100 minimum, and I don't care whether that's a 2x4, an hour worth of labor or whatever that is. If it costs me $100 at minimum, I'm going to charge $150 for it. That's a 50% markup, because a 50% markup gives me a 33% margin. And if, again, I'm going to, this is boring number stuff. If I have a 33% margin, I can afford to spend 20% on my expenses and have a 13% net profit. Mm-hmm. The reason I shoot for 13 is because I'm not perfect. Things are going to come up. So I've got a little fluff in there. If I lose 2, 3, 4%, I'm still going to end up around 10% net profit is where I want to be. So the first thing is they just simply are not charging enough. It's not because of anything fancy. It's because they don't have enough cost data to know what a thing actually costs them.
Gotcha. Not understanding baseline accounting.
Yeah. So I see this all the time in our clients' books, especially the ones that we do the bookkeeping for. In general, there's a difference from it. Now we're talking just pure accounting stuff here. There's a difference between an expense and a bill. So for example, my guys go out in the field, they've got their Home Depot card, they go buy some 2x4s for a project. That money changes hands right then between the, you know, my credit card account and
the point of sale.
And Home Depot. So a transaction is created, right? I don't get a bill. Well, I don't get a bill necessarily, an invoice. I get a receipt, right? That's an expense. That appears on the books within a couple of days. Now I go to the lumber yard or my building supplier and I order $100,000 worth of thing, of materials for a project. That supplier, my vendor, gives me 30 days to pay that. A lot of contractors take that bill, that invoice that they get, and it sits on their desk and they try to remember to pay it by the end of the month. But technically today, when I made that order, my business owes another business $100,000. Now, I don't need to pay for that $100,000 for 30 days, but that should be reflected on the books. The way that that gets reflected on the books is I got to enter a bill so that when I'm looking at a report called accounts receivable, I can see how much money do I owe people. And when is that stuff due? Is it due in 30 days, 45 days, 60 days? And I can balance that against my accounts receivable to say, who owes me? And if I'm looking at accounts payable and it's $200,000 that need to go out in the next 2 weeks, and I've only got $50,000 coming in the next 2 weeks, I'm going to the bank account to say, do I have the difference? Because these things have got to be paid. So some of that baseline accounting and workflow of making sure those transactions get onto the books. Because the other thing, like Benji, if you had a construction company and you had all this money out to suppliers and I come in and say, hey, I want to invest in your business, or maybe I want to buy your business. If the money that you owe isn't reflected on there, then the numbers aren't accurate. The value of your business isn't accurate in any given time. And we want to keep the value of the business accurate so that we can use, you know, lines of credit, or if we use financing or whatever. Well, I want to know what this thing is that I created is worth, other than like how I feel about it.
100%.
Because most contractors feel, I got a great business. And I hear that all the time. Hey, Sean, I want you to get some coaching. I think I'm going to sell the business. You know, I get this a lot from sons. They're like, hey, dad wants me to buy him out. And I look at the numbers and I'm like, what does your dad want you to buy? Excuse me. There's nothing here. Yeah. Like I understand you got a great reputation. You know, there may be some value in the reputation, but as far as the finances go, you're actually in debt. Mm-hmm. I don't know that I would buy this business. Mm-hmm. Sorry to be the bearer of bad. No, it's worth a lot more. Again, anything is worth what somebody's willing to pay for it. But that's some of where the baseline accounting is just off.
The other thing that you mentioned is over hiring. And I have thoughts on this too. When you look at people with really challenging profit situations, how much of that can you trace back to just pulling the trigger on people too early, hiring the wrong people, over hiring in the wrong role, stuff like that?
Yeah, in general, we see that people contractors will over hire because they are busy or they've got a lot of work. But that's having a lot of work and being busy or being, you know, having the schedule being starting to back up is not necessarily a reflection of profitability. But one of the metrics that we always look at is revenue per employee. Historically, over time, what is your revenue per employee? Now, this revenue per employee is not a measure of profitability. It's more a measure
efficiency.
Of efficiency or productability, I would call like that. So if I see a revenue per employee of $250,000, that's usually, you know, in a pretty good range. Depends on the business. But then the owner's like, oh man, we're really busy. We've got to get, I don't know, these projects past the finish line or start these other ones. We need more people. And I'm like, okay, you might need to hire two more people. But if you hire two more people,
are you going to be able to maintain that revenue per employee? You got to look out and say, okay, I've got two people on that's going to cost me, let's say, over $100,000 in salaries and benefits, or, you know, or whatever else it is. You might need that to get those projects done, but you got to look ahead and say, I got to drive more revenue because we need more revenue to divide against, you know, more employees so that we keep our revenue per employee where it is. And most contractors, it's a very simple metric to track and to look back historically. You don't have to do a deep financial analysis because most business owners are like, hey, how many employees did you have last year and what was your revenue? Yeah. Divide those numbers. You got it. Like, that's your revenue per employee. You can break it down by quarter. Hey, this year, how many employees you got? You know how many employees you have. And what do you think you're going to be doing in revenue? Mm. Compare those two numbers. Mm. And if you do that over time, it just gives you one of those boundaries to say, man, we're really busy right now. I think we need to hire somebody for what we see in front of us. But you got to look out and say, wait a minute.
Yeah.
That might solve the problem today, but 6 months from now, if we don't have more work or more revenue coming in, we're going to be sitting around just trying to keep people busy.
I really like that as kind of a guide, as sort of a green light, yellow light, red light type exercise of doing it's very simple napkin math, by the way, to calculate if you are quote unquote, you know, green lit to go and hire someone because, hey, our revenue per employee is way higher than it was a few quarters ago, that would be a signal that you can't afford to bring someone on. But if you're just busy and the revenue per employee is the same as it's always been, well, then you're just busy. And that's not your feeling of the matter is not, generally speaking, a good indicator of when you should pull the trigger on a new position, especially non-revenue producing ones. I think that's the place where people get into a lot of trouble, especially builders. Is you have what we call a bloated overhead, which are production managers, operations managers, marketing managers, design teams. You could make the case that design teams are technically revenue producing, but you have this whole section of the org chart that is not actually building, that is not actually doing invoiceable work. And that can get away from you very quickly. So I love that note. And then this last one, incentivizing employees to do their job. What do you mean by this?
Again, this, I think, goes back to what we talked about at the very beginning, was about contractors being people pleasers, which is not an insult. It's just an issue they need to be aware of. And part of that people pleasing is, man, we've worked our butts off this year, whether we made profit or not or whatever. Everybody on the team works really hard. If you've got, you know, if you've got great people. And I love that. I'm so happy when I hear, man, we've got the best people. Okay, cool. Awesome. Did you guys make any money? No. All right, cool. You got great people. That's awesome. Good job. You're not making any money. We need to change some of that. Anyway, all of that to say is I see this a lot of times with business owners, and we're heading into that time of year where they just start handing out Christmas bonuses. Mm. And I always tell, don't ever give anyone a bonus if they don't understand why they're getting it, because it turns into entitlement down the road. I don't know why I got $500 at Christmas, other than the boss was really nice and they think great things about, oh, he's so generous. But if it's not tied to something, some direct performance of the business, then I'd say don't call it a bonus. Call it what it is.
A gift.
It's a gift. Mm. If at Christmas time, you want you and your spouse or your business partner or whatever, you haven't evaluated your employees, you haven't given them like their improvement plans or skills that they're working on or whatever. If you just give them money, they're going to be super happy about it. And then they're going to be like, I don't know what I did to get that. I hope I get it next year. Boss is a really nice guy. Hmm. So if it is a gift, meaning it's not based on anything, you're just loving on your people, which, don't get me wrong, I think that's a great thing. Just tell them, hey, we love everybody here. We want to give you this gift and say Merry Christmas. Yeah. We want to say Happy 4th of July. We want to say Happy Second Tuesday in October. Whatever the reason is, just don't call it a bonus and don't make it, unless it's based on the performance of the business. And what I find is that when contractors, they feel like they need to do something for their employees, and especially employees that maybe aren't that great. And every now and then they step up and they're just like, oh, awesome. I need to give this person a bonus or something else. I want to go back to their job description and be like, wait a minute. Isn't that thing just part of their job? I don't want to incentivize people to just do their job. That's what the paycheck is for. That's what the job at a great company, that's part of the benefit is like, yeah, this is a great place to work. I don't want to incentivize you to do your job. I want to incentivize you to go create more opportunities for yourself. And if those opportunities also benefit the company, that's a really great thing.
It's a shame, you know, it's kind of a shame that this is the case, but it is. And like you said, like you do kind of need to just confront the truth. Blind generosity also has a cost. You end up being a schmuck like 5 years down the road. You have a crew, bunch of people who expect more than they probably deserve. And I think that desire to be generous with your people comes from a really noble place, when you want to cherish, when we want to honor. But if you can make it a little bit more objective, a little bit more empirical, a little bit more results-based, not only are you going to get more out of your people, they're going to get more out of the experience too. $500, like I would not trade, let's say, a few $1,000 in bonuses over a few years, like getting that for all. I wouldn't like accept that if it also meant I had to accept entitlement as a part of my system and a part of my attitude now too. So you're not actually doing anyone any favors. We're almost out of time, but we'll have to have you back for a part two, Sean. I want to close on this. Okay. We're headed into I don't know what we're headed into. I'm not an economist. I'm not going to say that we're headed into a recession, but I am hearing from members, things are feeling tighter. Things are feeling more competitive. Lead flow is down. Sales velocity is down. Average ticket is down pretty much across the board, Canada and the US. What is your advice for profitability advice? This could be mindset. It could be a system. It could be a tactic, whatever. But just one piece of advice for people to make more when things get competitive.
Yeah. I think I first said this post COVID, because everybody was asking, well, what do we do now? How do we change or whatever? Or a lot of people kind of, as I say, got caught with their pants down because they didn't have certain systems or certain things in place. And we all got, you know, caught by surprise. But then when things normalized a little bit, they went back to things as normal. And I said, hey, when the world changes, change your business. And you've been doing this for years too. I have to, years ago, I can remember coaching clients and saying, yeah, we'll meet on Zoom. And that's how we, you know, deliver our product or service. And I was like, by the way, you can meet with your clients on Zoom. You don't have to run out there and give them an estimate, at least for the, and they were like, no, that can't happen. Like our clients would never do that. Or contractors are not up on a lot of the latest technology, at least, you know, a few years ago. Then the world changed. And in an instant, every contractor said, yeah, we can meet on Zoom. It's not a problem. You know, so just be aware in the big picture of when the world changes, you got to change your business. And one of the ways the world is changing now is the costs for everything are going up. Inflation is higher than it's ever been. Again, I'm not an economist either, but just at the grocery store, bread is 3 or 4 times it was, whatever it is. I don't know exactly the number. My wife buys all the bread, right? But I know that food costs have gone up. And then I look at a construction business and I'm like, you haven't even raised your prices 5%. Well, it's really expensive for not many people can afford it. The world is changing. Change your business. Yes, the people and the income brackets that you served before, you can't serve them anymore. There's not enough meat left on that bone. That's very unfortunate. But if you want to run a business, change your business in the way that the world has changed. So markets are changing, interest rates are changing, and all of that kind of stuff. But what I tell contractors is, I'm not really too worried about certain market conditions, or especially for custom home builders, anybody wanting to do high-end stuff. Then I'll say, if you're really worried about it, take a weekend, take your spouse, and go buy an airplane ticket and just fly somewhere. And when you get on that airplane, as long as there are people sitting in first class, as long as people are driving Mercedes-Benz, BMWs, and as long as all-inclusive resorts are being booked up, don't worry about it. Just those people are spending premium dollars on a premium service. Figure out what that needs to be for your company. That doesn't mean we have a $1,000 service, we're going to start charging $10,000 for it. But we could charge $2,000 if we increase the experience that won't cost us $1,000 extra. There's a $100 thing that you could add that you could charge another $1,000 for, and your customers will love it for you. And it won't put you into a bracket where you're dealing with the wealthiest of wealthy. So the technology and the systems are available out there. Just look for ways that how can we, if we spend a dollar more, how can we leverage that dollar and charge $10 for it? Because your customers don't care about the cost. They care more about the experience. And that applies to every business. There's something in your business that you can 10X.
It's incredibly well said and timely. Sean, I really appreciate the time and the insights and the work you do. Keep it up. Where can people connect with you if they want to?
Yeah, they can connect with me you can just Google me. You should see most of my stuff, SeanVanDyke.com. Our coaching programs are at Built to Build Academy, another academy out there for contractors. And then also this year, we also launched the Data Mule data management services. So it's basically what I tell people, it's bookkeeping, but on steroids for contractors. So if you want to just hit me up, right away, you can just shoot me a DM on Instagram at Sean Van Dyke on Instagram. And then the book Profit First for Contractors is available on Amazon, on Audible. Just type that in. And please, if you grab the book, please leave me a review. It's so helpful to get that into more contractors' hands.
Thank you, Sean. Take care, buddy. We'll do this again soon.
All right. Thanks, Benji. See ya.
Thanks a lot for listening to this episode of Contractor Evolution. If you've already subscribed to our channel, consider sharing this episode with another contractor who you think needs to hear it.